talking about the NB Center. So this was the defect in Diamond. And you remember that we have a diamond lattice? And we take and put the nitrogen in one place and a vacancy in the other. And this piece, although it has 6 electrons, looks like it has 2 electrons that are strongly exchanged coupled. And this is a minus defect, so we add an extra electron. So 2 electrons and although we haven't said it, it's useful to remember that real quantum systems are never so clean. And so what we do is we look at them and say, what's the most important interaction? And we take that as the interaction which is going to define the energy landscape, and then everything else has to be relative to that. And so here, what we're saying is that in the low field limit, then the exchange interaction is going to be the dominant interaction. Now, of course, there's electronic interactions that are important too, but they're not going to be important over the energy landscape that we want to qubit. So we end up having a Hamiltonian that is the exchange interaction SZ squared plus some Zeeman interaction that goes as SZ, plus we're going to add some terms. So this is the exchange. And it is often called the zero field splitting because it's a splitting in zero field. And of course, since it shows up as SZ squared, we end up having a term where there's a splitting between the zero and the plus and minus one states. And there's no energy difference between plus one and minus one. And MS is the magnetic quantum number of the effective spin one particle made up of 2 exchanging electron spins. So this is the electronic ground state. And then there's the electronic excited state. And the difference in energy is red light. And if we excite this, it's always going to fall back down and emit a photon. And this process is spin conserving in general. This separation is 3 gigahertz. This separation here depends upon the field. So this is proportional to the magnetic field strength. And the last piece is that there was the singlet state, which is also MS equals zero, but with a symmetry that is odd instead of even, right? This is all even symmetry states, and this is an odd symmetry state. And this piece is weakly allowed. So if I'm exciting with a laser from the plus minus one state, I'll cycle back and forth between those two. But one third of the time, it'll transition to the singlet state. And the singlet state decays with a long lifetime of about 300 nanoseconds, whereas these decays are about 35 nanoseconds. Now we showed two other things. We showed that we could excite with the green light, which is higher energy, and it would fall down into the electronic excited state very quickly and then do the same thing. And that's an important piece for the experiment. You know, it's not important for the physics of understanding the system, but for the experiment, it's important. And it allows us to have this geometry of a confocal microscope. And so what we have is our laser that goes through a pinhole that defines a focal spot. It impinges on a lens, which is then focused into our sample. And I put the dichroic mirror here with another focal spot and a single photon detector. And so we excite in the green, and we detect in the red. And by doing that, this detector won't be overwhelmed by the green light that we're exciting it in. And the emission is in all directions. So the emission is a point source. So if you don't do anything special, the probability that the photon that's emitted will actually appear at your detector is low. Okay. Now you can make a photonic device, or you can put mirrors. There are other things you can do. But that's okay. That at this point, all we care about is that there is a probability that a photon reaches the detector. And it's useful. We want to have a system where we have an individual defect in our piece, where we can really look at quantum dynamics with strong measurement in a single quantum system. And so we want to prove that we have one quantum system. And there's a simple way of doing that, given by Hanbury, Brown, and Twiss, and probably Kevin Resch told you about this. Yes? Good. So we take our single photon, we go through a mirror, a half-silvered mirror, so a beam splitter. We have two detectors. So this is the source. So effectively, this goes here, and I measure the correlation in time. If I measure that correlation in time via a parameter called delta t, which is the difference in time of those two detectors, what I'll see is a dip right at delta t equals zero. If there's a single photon. So of course, this event, this piece, if I'm shining the green light, I'm exciting the system, and it's continually giving off photons, right? But it's always giving, if I have one microscopic system in this confocal spot, it's always giving off one photon at a time. And so if there's one photon and it comes through this beam splitter, then it can only go to one detector or the other. And therefore, the correlation, which says both the detectors fired, goes to zero when this timing is right. When the timing is wrong, then of course I could be detecting one photon from one event and a photon from another event. And so the shape of this tells me about the timing of the system. Yeah? Okay. Now, we saw that based upon the selection rules, so that for that weakly allowed transition, which is called an intersystem crossing, that weakly allowed transition occurs only from plus and minus one, never from zero. And if I use that, then I can show that if I turn the laser on, I can have a preparation and if I have each of the states with 1/3 probability to start with, then as I turn the laser on, the zero state will become populated and the MS equal one will become depopulated. And if I wait long enough, then I'll completely populate the zero state. It turns out that you don't actually completely populate it. You populate it to something like 95%, but you can do a good job. So we can have step preparation that just turns the laser on. And the other piece that we saw was that we could have readout because if I'm in the zero state, the photon number, so the number of photons detected, versus counting time with the laser on. If I'm in MS equals zero, we always count the same. It's only a cycling transition. The longer you count, the more. But if I'm in plus or minus one, the initial slope is slower. And then eventually, it's the same counting statistics of zero. Because we end up in the zero manifold and that just cycles. And so if I choose the time right, then I can have a probability of detecting photons versus number of photons. Number of photons detected. And this is in an interval. And this is the probability of that number. And what I want is to have two distributions, one for the number of photons in the MS equals zero manifold, And they have to be more, right? Because you're, the MS equals zero always gives you all of its photons back. And the MS equals one or minus one will give less. And what will happen, of course, is if I counted for too long, then these distributions, I would get more photons, but they would become closer and closer together. And if I counted too short, well, then they would be broad because they're so noisy, right? And so there's an optimal. And at the optimal, we want to have whatever overlap there is. And so this is a nice piece to calculate sometime. But we get this. Now notice that our observable. So if I think about an observable, I want to write the observable as a projector, right? And the observable are the operators 0 and the operators 1. Right? So I have two projectors, one that's a zero state and one that is the sum of the plus and one states. Good. Okay. So now we turn the field on. And so what happens is as I increase the magnetic field, these levels split. And of course, we get the minus one and the plus one state, and the zero state stays as it was. We recall that this is 3 gigahertz about, and this splitting is 2.8 megahertz per Gauss. Now, I remind you that the Earth's magnetic field is half a Gauss. Okay? And so here we have a splitting, which for small fields is a small part of that. We could make it bigger, but normally we want to work at small fields. Okay? And now we're asked, well, how do we have control in this system? Yeah?
So now that we turn on the magnetic field, we got zeros, now we can have 0, 1, and minus 1.
Yeah. That's right. And it's important, if I come back to this picture, notice that if I have the diamond, then the nitrogen vacancy defect creates an orientation in the diamond. And if I want to look at this structure, then I have to take the magnetic field direction as given by the crystal structure of the diamond and the defect in that diamond crystal structure. So I want this Z to be defined by the direction of the NV. And so if I turn on a static magnetic field, then I have to be careful to orient it in the right direction. And if I orient it in some other direction, then what happens is there'll be a little contribution that looks like sigma x. And that sigma x contribution will lead to a mixing of the eigenstates of under the exchange interaction. So that will screw things up. Okay, so we'll, it's a nice set of physics to look at. We won't look at it. We'll just assume that we've been careful. The other piece to think about is that if I look at substituting a nitrogen, there are four different orientations that the vacancy could be in. And so if I look at one defect and I align the magnetic field to that defect, and then I go and I look at another defect, the orientation of the second defect might be different than the first one. Of course, it's most likely different. Yeah? Okay. Now, if we look here, there's a nice piece of physics as I look at this manifold. So within these three states, we know that there are two allowed transitions, that this transition is allowed because it involves a single spin flip, right? Allowed transitions, dipole allowed transitions, are those that involve one spin flip. And this is allowed but this transition would involve both electron spins flipping. So this transition is forbidden. Right, because the plus one state is two spins up and the minus one states are two spins down. And so it would be a two spin process to have that. So although this transition might be the one we're interested in, directly we can't drive it. We have to drive it indirectly. Okay? Now I want to look at this piece again. So we've got this piece where we have 0, minus 1, plus 1. And of course, because this and this are allowed transitions, we can drive these transitions with a transverse microwave field. And so I can say, oh, let's take and add to our Hamiltonian the microwave control field. And so we'll have a term that looks like omega 1, which is in our control. And now, let's keep that this term is 3 gigahertz, what we call delta. And let's make this small. So I'm going to have omega 1, which is an amplitude, times cosine of, I'll use delta here, and now it's worth in this point to, you can see it either way, but I'm going to write it out in the two spin basis. Like that. Okay. So, we have two exchange coupled spins. But I'll write it out this way. And this is, of course, a nice symmetric operator, so it's all good. And we have this control term. Now, given this, what you would normally do is you'd say, oh, well, this is what's happening in the lab frame. And then you would go to a rotating frame. And you saw that in your homework, right? Good. Now I want to look at what happens here. So normally in the rotating frame, you would say that I go from having, and we'll do this first for one spin, one half. So one qubit. You would say in the lab frame, I would have a spin that would evolve with some frequency. We'll call it omega naught. And then you would go into your rotating frame. Where you've rotated about the z-axis. So you're going to rotate about z at the frequency of omega naught. And then your spin becomes stationary. And you say that you want to put your field here. And therefore, if you went back, your control field should be here and also rotating at omega naught. And then the angle between them is always going to be constant. And that's good, right? Because if I have a, you know, the motion of any qubit is always a torque. So I want to have an angle between them so I can introduce a torque. Now then we go and we look at the envy. So in the envy case, I still have coherences, right? This term here was a coherence between up and down, appropriately scaled, right? In the NV case, we still have a coherence. So we have a coherence here. So this is in the lab frame. That is 0 plus plus 1 over the square root of the 2. And it's going to rotate at a frequency delta. But in addition, I have a coherence which is going to be 0 plus minus 1 over the square root of the 2. And it's going to rotate in the opposite direction. It's going to rotate at the frequency of minus delta. And so when you go into the rotating frame, you can see that I need to go into two different rotating frames. I can go into one rotating frame where I rotate about z by plus delta, and one where I rotate about z by minus delta. And in this laboratory frame, this vector becomes stationary, and this vector rotates by minus 2 delta. And in this frame, this vector becomes stationary. So this is stationary. This piece becomes stationary. And the other one rotates by plus 2 delta. So this is in the rotating frames. So now then we have this weird thing that says I've got a three-level system, and depending upon the way I rotate the microwave field, I'll connect to either a coherence of the 0 plus 1 or I'll connect to a coherence of the 0 minus 1. So even though the transitions between plus one and minus one are not allowed. We still have universal control, provided we can control the helicity of the microwave field. So if I have the microwave field, then I want to think about, instead of having, where did I lose it? Instead of having just the cosine term, I want to add the sine term as well, so that I can have a control piece that allows me to rotate either to the plus one or to the minus one state. Okay? All right, so now we have our rotating frame, and we can see that. And it's worthwhile to take this and look at this in terms of the spin dynamics. So if I was just to take that cosine term, right? Remember how it works with the rotating frame approximation. You take the cosine term and you decompose that into a right and left-handed rotation. And then for a spin 1/2, you just keep one of them and you go into that frame. Here, you have to keep both, but you keep one of them for the 0, 1, and you keep the other one for the 0, -1, okay? And if you really only have a cosine, then of course you're driving those two the same. And so then I would think about a Hilbert space for a spin 1 Hilbert space. And so I have my space indexed like this. And of course, I'm going to, for 1 qubit, I live in this space. And sigma x for this qubit, of course, is that. And for the other qubit, I live in this space. And sigma x is this. But this state participates in both of those qubits. Yeah? And so take this operator, which we would call Sx in the spin 1 space, and show me the states that you create as you apply that operator to a system that starts off only in the zero state. So for homework, take your initial state, psi, as equal to the zero state, and then apply a rotation of theta for Sx, and tell me what you create. And I particularly care about what you would create as a coherence between the plus one and minus one states. Okay? Good. Now, given this, what we've shown is that you have one spin, one qubit. And you could treat it, if I only live in this space, if I find a way of turning this off, I can live in just a qubit space, or I could treat it as a qutrit. Either way, I get the control I want. Now, we want to have a bigger Hilbert space. And the electron spin is a good qubit, but it's not as good a qubit as the nuclear spins. So I want to have a way of engaging the nuclear spins. And the first nuclear spins are the three nitrogens. It turns out that they're not the nicest. And so, although normally, if we had more time, I would go into the nitrogen dynamics, let's just talk about an envy connected to a carbon 13, and we'll neglect the nitrogen 14. Nitrogen 14 is a spin one as well. Nitrogen comes in two flavors, nitrogen 14, nitrogen 15. Nitrogen 14 is by far the most abundant, and it's a spin one. Nitrogen 15 is a spin one half. Carbon, of course, comes in two flavors, carbon 12, which has no spin, and carbon 13, which is 1% abundant and has a spin of one half. Okay. Now the splitting, the Zeeman splitting for carbon is equal to about 1,000 hertz per Gauss. And over here somewhere, we told you that the splitting of the NV system was 2.8 megahertz per Gauss. And so this is very, very small compared to the system. And now I want to look at two interactions with the electron spin and the carbon spin. And so if I write down the Hamiltonian, the system Hamiltonian will be delta SC squared for the nitrogen, omega electron SZ for the Zeeman splitting of the electron. Let's put Z in electron. It'll be omega Zeeman nuclear, sigma Z. And now, remember that the carbon is a spin one half. Right, so we're in a tensor product space of a spin one tensor to spin one half, right? So the Hilbert space is spin one tensor, spin one half. All right? Now this, everything still commutes, right? So this is boring so far, right? We wouldn't have any control. And so we need to something that is a little bit more exciting. And there's two pieces that come from the hyperfond interaction. And I'm just going to call them omega A and omega B. Now, the way this works is that the hyperfine interaction is a magnetic-magnetic interaction between two magnetic centers. So the hyperfine interaction has a through-space component, which is going to look like SZ, SZ minus some other terms that won't be important. So it'll look like SZ, SZ. And that falls off as 1 over the distance cubed, just like you would have for two classical magnetic dipoles. And the reason that we keep the Z part is that's the part that commutes with the total Hamiltonian. And then there's a term that is S dot sigma. And that depends upon a polarization of the electron cloud. So imagine I have I have a molecular orbital. The molecular orbital, which contains the electron that has spin, overlaps with the nucleus. And that overlap is a so-called Fermi contact term. And that leads to a polarization of the nuclear spin via the electron spin. And you know that the only electronic orbitals that have overlap with the nucleus are S orbitals, right? Everything else has a node there. So provided your molecular orbital has S characteristics to it, then the electron spin can directly overlap in a through bond way with the spin of the nucleus, and you can polarize it. All right? So that's where this comes from. Now, it's interesting to say, well, you know, this term clearly should be there. But this term, why is that term there? And that term is there. I have to sit down for a second. My leg bothers me. That term is there because the electron energy, spin energy, is so much larger than the nuclear spin energy. So we're quantized in the electron spin. So SZ of the electron spin is a good quantum number. But the nuclear spin flips, well, they're only changing things by a kilohertz out of 3 gigahertz. So the nuclear spins aren't good quantum numbers. And therefore, I should include all of the operators that are proportional to SZ or SZ squared, but I should include all of those tensored with every operator of the nuclear spins. So I should include sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z. Well, what I've done is included sigma x and sigma z because, of course, I get sigma y out of the action of those on each other. So by including just x and z, I've included everything. Okay, now then, we come over here and show you a small way that this helps. And I want to do this for a spin 1/2 electron. So, you know, as an aside, we're on the sideboard. We can have asides on the sideboard. We have a spin 1/2 electron, a spin 1/2 nucleus. And I want to look at the control, and the Hamiltonian for this is going to be the Zeeman of the electron plus the Zeeman of the nucleus plus a term which is the coupling of those two plus this term. I guess they called it A. I'll keep calling it A. Now, I want to think about what the effective Hamiltonian on the nucleus looks like, conditioned on the electron spin state. Because the electron is a good quantum number. And the spin states are, of course, plus and minus 1/2 of the electron spin. You know, normally what I would do is I would say, oh, we can rewrite this in terms of the idempotents spin up and spin down, and we can expand it. But at the moment, let's just plug them in. So we say that we have a Hamiltonian for the electron spin up that looks like, well, there's this piece, but I only care about the nuclear spin, so we forget it. There's this piece, which doesn't depend on the electron. There's this piece that depends upon the electron, omega A sigma Z N divided by 2. And because I'm tracing out the electron spin is no longer there, right? And there's this piece that says I have plus omega B sigma X nucleus. I shouldn't be going between lowercase and capitals, divided by 2. And of course, if I write down the Hamiltonian in the case that the electron spin is down, I just change those two signs. And now it's worthwhile to look at the effective field. Right? So we add all the contributions here. And if I have the spin up case, well, then I have a term that is along the z-axis. That's omega zn. I have a term along the z-axis. That's omega a over 2. And I have a term along the x-axis. That's omega b over 2. And if I look at, so that's electron up. And if I look at the electron down, well, I still get this term. But the other two come in negative. So I get the term that's minus omega a over 2. And I get the term that's minus omega b over 2. So if we look at the effective field, so the effective field, of course, is just the vector sum of these fields. So this is the effective field for electron up. So this is the effective field, of course, is what the nucleus is going to rotate about. So this says, oh yeah, if the electron's up, we're going to rotate about this direction. And of course, oops. If the electron's down, I'm going to rotate about this direction. And you see a nice thing, I hope, that those two axes of rotation are not aligned with each other. And so if I rotate, if I allow the nuclear spin to evolve with the electron spin up, it'll rotate about this axis. And then if I switch the electron spin, but I don't do anything else, the nucleus will rotate about this axis. And so I get the universal control of the nuclear spin by just modulating the electron spin. I don't need to do anything else. All I need to do is change the state of the electron spin. And by changing the state of the electron spin, I control the state of the nuclear spin. And I can do that very effectively because these terms are quite large. So the hyperfine field for an NV, it depends upon which carbon you're talking about, right? Because it depends upon distance and it depends upon bonds. But the strongest one is a little bit more than 100 megahertz. So that if I thought about, well, how fast could I modulate the nuclear spin by controlling the electron spin, I can do it at up to 100 megahertz, depending upon the actual nuclear spin I'm talking about. Okay, so here we have a nice way of having universal control in the system. And so this allows me now to build into my NV system a way of connecting. And come on. Thank you. And the way I want to think about this is to say, imagine I have, actually, I'm going to save that argument for next class, and I want to give you a simple example of this, because we're going to run out of time, so let's do something quick. So we talk about an experiment to repeatedly measure the electron, the NV state, enabled by a C13. is I'll take the initial state to be where this is the C13 state. So maybe I call that up. And this is the electron. And I'll work with just the 0-1 manifold. And of course, what I want to do is I want to learn alpha and beta. Now, the first piece I'm going to do is to take this state and apply a controlled NOT gate that conditionally rotates the carbon based upon the electron state. And so now I'm going to end up with a state which is alpha 0 up plus beta 1 down, right? I end up with this entangled state. You know, it's entangled depending upon what the choice of alpha and beta is. Now I turn on my laser and I measure. Now measuring, of course, just the electron, just the NV, right? So what do I see when I make a measurement here? So I make a measurement by turning on the laser and counting photons, you know, just like we did up there. And so what I see if I do that is, you're going to answer the question by saying, with probability blank, you observe blank. So you'll remember that our measurement observables are here. So these are the only things that I can get out. So with some probability, I measure zero. That probability is?
One alpha spin.
Yeah, so with probability given by alpha squared, I measure zero. And with probability given by beta squared, I measure one. Now here's the tricky part. What is the state that I leave the system in if I measure zero? So you say, if I measure zero, I end up with the state zero up. And if I measure one, I end up with the state
one.
So you want to say one down. But remember that whenever we turn the laser on, we prepare the system in the state zero. Right? So because our measurement process always returns the NV in the state zero, so we learn that we're in this branch. But the state we end up with is the state zero down. And then what I'm going to do is apply another controlled knot. But I'm going to, instead of rotating the carbon, I'm going to rotate the NV conditional on the carbon, right? Because the nuclear spin still has the memory of what that state was. So here I apply a set of controlled knots. to get zero up. And one down. And what happens when I make a measurement again? So I'm going to make a measurement at this point. When I make a measurement, see, the control knot doesn't care, right? It's a unitary gate. It acts correctly on either of these, right? This is the same gate. So there was no, the experiment wasn't conditioned. The outcome is conditioned. And so if I measure here, I'll end up back here with probability 1. And if I measure here, I'll end up back here with probability 1. And we can keep measuring as long as the nuclear spin preserves its state. So for a time of the T1 of the nuclear spin, we can keep sampling. So I can make this measurement 100 times, and I'll still gain statistics. But if I do this process once, and I measured 100 times, so I get enough statistics, do I measure an expectation value? So we're out of time, but the answer is no. Because if I want to measure an expectation value, I need to repeat this step here, right? So in order to measure an expectation, so this gives me, improves the statistics of each element's measurement. But I need to sample over these elements in order to get to an expectation value.
Like an ensemble of 10.
Yeah. Yeah, in this case, it'll be an ensemble over time that I have to keep repairing this state again and then sample from this state through the whole thing. Okay, let's stop here and then we'll continue.